This evening I'd like to speak about identification with thought. Thoughts can be very difficult objects for meditation for many people, primarily because they change so rapidly. One thought leads to another. They are so fleeting and so quick. And not only do they happen very quickly, but usually we believe them just because we thought them. And when you looked at your minds today, how many thoughts were really true? Really true. If you were thinking about the past, did it really happen that way? If you were thinking about the future, I guarantee it isn't true. The Buddha said, "No other thing do I know, O monks, that changes so quickly as the mind. It is not easy to give a simile for how quickly the mind changes." Now, the Buddha was known for coming up with similes. Similes, metaphors, comparisons, illustrations. He'd say it's just like a cow in a pasture, or that's just like the sun on a spring day, or it's just like a flower sprouting from a, or it's just like the porridge in a pot, or it's just like the oil in a this, or it's just like the plow in the field. He had comparisons for everything. He couldn't think of anything that could compare to how quickly the mind changes, how quickly thoughts arise. One of the things we practice with is working with our thoughts. Did anybody work with thoughts today? I should see a lot of heads going, yes, 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 because I'm sure there were a few thoughts out there. The problem with thoughts is when we believe them, we are consumed by them. It's almost as another verse, another statement in a Pali verse in the Buddha said, this was said to the Buddha in a question. He said, it's like being eaten by your thoughts. Do you ever feel eaten by your thoughts? Gobbled up by them, consumed by them? We can investigate and understand our thoughts so that we are not consumed by them, but instead we understand them as they are. As vivid and as pervasive and as lasting as a plan might be, a fantasy, a memory, or an interpretation, they don't have to disturb us, and they won't disturb us if we don't cling to them. Thoughts disturb us when we use them as a support for our identity. How many thoughts did you have today that were about yourself? What you did, what you want to do, what you like, what you don't like, what somebody said to you, what you're going to say back to them. Sometimes we act and think like we're the center of the universe. But when we don't identify with the thoughts, when we don't take them personally, take them to be who and what we are, we may open to a knowing that is beyond concept, that is beyond the realm of the discursive mind. But to glimpse beyond thought, we must know the workings of the mind very well. A clear and thorough understanding of how the mind works, of the conditioned aspects of the mind, is what precedes a realization of the unconditioned. We have to know the conditioned very well to go beyond it. Srinisargadatta Maharaj said, you have to be very alert, or else your mind will play false with you. It's like watching a thief. Not that you expect anything from the thief, but you don't want to be robbed. In the same way, you give a lot of attention to the mind without expecting anything from it. And sometimes when we watch the mind, it's just like that. We know it's going to steal the precious present wakefulness away from us if we don't watch diligently. And so we are alert. We're mindful. We're attentive. One of the first practices we do with thoughts is to just let them go. We learn to let them go. We try to clear a space in the mind, a quiet place that's free from the compulsive clutter. In fact, much of what we do in the early part of our meditation practice is just to let go of some of those thoughts. It's not that we're pushing the thoughts away. It's that we're letting go of the entrancement with them. But then, sometimes things get entrancement, fascination, seduction, being pulled in. Thoughts are often attractive to us, alluring. They feel entertaining. And as the mind gets quiet, sometimes we feel a little bored. Nothing's happening. What's going on here? Why did I come? This isn't very fun. Why don't they play a movie? I was at one meditation center, which was a personal retreat center. And everybody goes there and gets an individual room and stays in their room. So you can go there for 2 weeks or a month or a year, and you just meditate in your room. You know, it's not a happening place. It's a retreat center. And I had to walk into the office one day. And there was a new yogi who had come to the retreat center just a couple of days before. And he's all agitated, and he was saying, I'm packing, I'm getting out of here. There's nothing to do. I've seen people come on retreats with tennis rackets. Bicycles, piles of books, things to entertain themselves. I saw a soccer ball once. It doesn't take very long once you're here in this retreat to realize that there really isn't anything in the schedule for playtime. Not even mindful soccer playing. We sit and we look at the mind and we let go of all the clutter, all the tendency to want to keep again and again entertaining ourselves, again and again reaching for stimulus. We learn to sit quietly. We learn to be quiet with the mind. We learn to be content with the experience of the present moment as it is. I think we're learning to be alive, to be awake to the present moment, to be alive for our life. Because we don't live in the past, and we don't live in our plans of the future. It's right here in the present moment. And if we're not awake for this, and if we find this boring without our books and our gadgets and our games and our telephones and our things, all our things, when are we going to be alive? Much of the compulsive thought is telling us I'm here. Yep, still here.
Yep,
still here. Like we could forget. I'm me. I like this. I don't like that. Like we could forget our preferences. So we take the time in meditation to just clear all that crud away, just to let it go. That wasn't a fancy English word. You don't have to translate crud. Crap, garbage, trash, useless stuff. This thought and that thought, and we just let it go. We just let it go. We just let it go. Now, I'm sure you've all let some thoughts go. If you didn't let them go, they've already gone on their own, right? Do you miss them? Did you really need them? Can you not live without them? I'll bet you don't miss a single one. And yet, in the moment, sometimes they seem so important, so compelling, that they sweep us away from the present moment, and we don't even feel ourselves sitting, and we don't even feel ourselves breathing, and we don't even know where we are. And so we let the thoughts go, we clear a space in the mind, we let go of the past, we let go of the commentary on the present, and we let go of our fantasies and interpretations, so that we can learn to genuinely be present, be here, right now. When thoughts arise, we don't have to judge ourselves for thinking or get angry that they arose. We just see them and let them go. And it's the letting go of saying, nah, you're not going to get me this time. I'm not going to be seduced into that one. We just don't bite the hook like a fish that bites a baited hook. We decide we are not going to bite that hook. We notice the thoughts arising. We notice that they've happened. But we're not attached to them, and so we observe them pass. Sometimes I think of it as just doing house cleaning, dusting, sweeping aside the thoughts, having a little feather duster in the mind that dusts the thoughts away. But as we're dusting away the mind, we have to kind of look at what is the source that's giving rise to all that dust. What are the sources for our thoughts? In Pali, there's a term called papancha. Sometimes, and there are three kinds of papancha, sometimes these are called the three obsessions or the three activities of mind that create identification or the three sources from which thought springs. Papancha in Pali literally translates or means to spread out. So in English, we say conceptual proliferation. We often experience this papancha, this proliferation of mind, as being swept up on a train of thought. One thought occurs, then another, then another, then another, and we're just pulled in to a scenario, a story. These three papanchas, or repetitive activities of mind, form the patterns that we call who I am. They form the patterns that we identify with. They are what we cling to when we create and cling to a sense of self. The first kind of papancha is called craving, tanha in Pali. This is one of the sources from which this proliferating thought springs, wanting. It's the basic question, what do I want? We work with Tanha through the cultivation of bare attention, seeing things as they are, and renunciation, being content with how things are. The primary delusion in Tanha is based on seeing more in the object than is actually there, so that we project happiness onto a situation that has no potential to bring us happiness. It's the delusion that presumes this is mine, and if I get it, I'll be happy. Craving is the belief that we can attain happiness by simply getting the things that we want. Now, don't tell the advertising industry that this doesn't work, but it doesn't work. You've tried it, right? Surely at some point or other you've gotten something that you wanted. Are you happy? No. As soon as you get it, guess what? You want something else, don't you? Happiness can never be found by getting what we desire, because there is suffering in the wanting itself. Craving and wanting distort our vision because they highlight a pleasant aspect, a hoped-for pleasure that just is not real. It's like the honeymoon syndrome, where everything seems so perfect at first, and then later we notice all our partner's irritating habits. Tanha blinds us. It prevents us from seeing the true nature of things. Often what we don't see are the unpleasant things. If craving is present, we tend to overlook whatever is unpleasant. It's a little bit like thinking, wouldn't it be so great to go on a picnic? There's this lovely spot I know. I think I'll go there and have a nice picnic with some friends. And we don't really think very much about it, except how wonderful it would be to go have a picnic. But then when we get there, we realize that morning we have to prepare the entire lunch before we leave. So we're making breakfast and we're making lunch, and we decided to go too early and there isn't time to do everything. So we're busy in the kitchen working really hard, and we don't have time to even wash the dishes. So then we race out with our hiking boots to go for our hike and our picnic, and then we have to carry everything and it's heavy. So there's the suffering of the carrying. And then when we finally get there to our favorite picnic spot, we realize that the ground is kind of uneven and rocky. There's no comfortable place to sit. And we find some little patch of place to sit, and then there are a whole bunch of ants there that come and find our picnic basket. And then somebody else comes over there and starts to make a kind of like a campfire barbecue, and there's all this smoke. Well, our perfect idealized picnic just wasn't happening. But that was the picnic. And that happens all the time, where we have an idea of how something is going to be. And the reality of it is that it is what it is. I don't know what you imagined 10 days of retreat would be like. Some of you have been on retreats, and you know perfectly well what it's like, but you forget, and so you come back. Some of you have never been on a retreat before, and so you innocently came, not knowing what to expect, but maybe there's a soccer ball in your duffel bag, and you just clued in before you took it out. Whatever you want, let it go, especially on a retreat. Desire will cause suffering. You might get it, you might not. But if you're wanting it, you'll be suffering. Why not just open to what actually is? See if we can simply be present for what is, without wanting, without craving. The insight that uproots craving is the insight into what's in Pali called dukkha, sometimes translated as stress, as suffering. I prefer suffering or unsatisfactoriness as the translation, but I'm reading a book now, and the translation that this author uses is troublesomeness. And I'm finding it quite amusing, because there is a quality to experience that is troublesome. And it's troublesome because it is a basis for craving, for clinging, for wanting. That's why experience is troublesome. And that is the essence of dukkha. Things are unsatisfactory because we cannot grasp them. We cannot hold them. Because our desires can never be fulfilled and lasting. The second form of papancha, the source from which thoughts spring. Oh, you might reflect if you had any thoughts today that were based on craving. Any scenarios in the mind, any thoughts that were based on craving. Just reflect if that one arose for you today. Now, the second source for proliferating thoughts is called conceit or mana. Do you want to translate that again? This is the proliferation based on comparing, on evaluating, better than, worse than, or equal to. When we decide we are better than we feel inflated, filled with pride, superior. This is best. I am best. When we feel less than we're diminished. It's worse, deflated, inferior. Conceit can also be determining that it is equal, the same as. That is also considered a conceit. Each way describes a mode that we distinguish ourselves from others. Conceit involves trying to measure a person or measure ourselves. But how can you measure a person? You can discern an action or as being more or less skillful, but you cannot measure a person. And yet we all compare. This function of conceit and comparing is actually not abandoned until the fourth and final stage of awakening. That means that every shred of greed and hate has long been gone before conceit vanishes. I mention that just so that you're patient with yourself. It might be around for a little while. And chances are you've seen some thought today that was a comparing thought. Through comparing, we construct a sense of who we are. Who are we? Who am I separate from you? Am I better than? Am I worse than? Am I equal to? Now, we are all going to agree that some of us are better at certain things, and other people are better at other things. My sister is a much better singer than I am. My brother is much better at computer programming. Some people run faster. Some people are good at math. Some people have a better ear for music. Different. You all speak Hebrew better than I do. Some of you may even speak English better than I do. We all have different skills. We all have different abilities. And so on a relative level, relatively speaking, it makes sense to compare. But the question with conceit is, are we using comparisons to build up a sense of identity, a sense of self, a self-image that we then become attached to? We are attached if we are threatened when our rank changes, when somebody else is better than us. Or we can recognize that we are attached when our ability fails. Maybe we're sick or injured and we can't do what we had always prided ourselves upon doing. We compare ourselves with other people. We compare ourselves with our own expectations, our own ideals. And we compare ourselves, our current abilities, with our past abilities. But the basic question of mana, conceit, is really, who am I? We work with conceit by contemplating change, recognizing the characteristic of impermanence. All mind, all matter, all aspects of mentality and materiality, the mind and the body, are continuously changing. Our abilities change with age, with injury, with who we compare ourselves with. It can be interesting in a group. Sometimes you walk into a group and you kind of rank yourself and you rank everybody else and you figure out who's who. And then some people leave the group and other people come in and the rank all changes. Somebody who was really, really so pathetic, just really inferior, has suddenly become quite superior as new people came into the group. And then somebody who had prided themselves on being so superior suddenly feels really threatened when other people that are more capable come into the group. So often we create a concept of who we are and who others are simply through these very relative comparisons. When we observe impermanence, when we observe change, we can let the insight that this too just arises and passes momentarily fill our experience. Yes, this too arises and passes. Yes, this too changes. The delusion in conceit is not the ability to discriminate, to be able to determine one person has more skill than this than another. Sometimes comparing is very useful. There's an aspect of discrimination, of discriminating wisdom, that is able to compare a useful experience with a painful one, to be able to compare a skillful action with an unskillful one. The delusion is simply in not seeing the impermanence. And so those conditioned patterns of judging, of comparison, of ranking, become a basis for self-construction. If we see that they're impermanent, we won't get caught by them. There's an interesting discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's actually quite a sweet little discourse, because there was this monk who was quite sick, Venerable Kemaka. And he was very ill, and a group of elder monks sent a messenger to go ask him, "How are you feeling? How are you holding up? How are you bearing?" And he said, "Oh, this hurts and that hurts, and I'm not this and that, but But he said, "This hurts and that is, all these things are not very well. These pains are ripping through my body." Like, it's very dramatic, actually. The poor guy was very sick. But he said, but he did not regard the aggregates, the aspects of body and mind, to be self or to belong to the self. And so the messenger went back and told the elders what Venerable Kemaka had said, that, oh, he was sick and this and that and this, but that he did not regard the body or the mind to be self or belonging to a self. And now the elder monks assumed that that meant that he had declared final awakening, that he had declared complete enlightenment. So they send the messenger back to comment on this and to ask, you know, oh, have you declared final awakening? And then, anyway, the messenger goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and they're having a conversation, like one sentence at a time. And finally, Venerable Kemaka, the one who's sick, says, enough with this running back and forth. Get me my staff. And so he goes with the messenger to meet the group of elder monks and explains to them that although the notion of the five aggregates, the aspects of body and mind are not, he understands that they are not a self or belonging to a self, that the notion I am has not yet vanished. And he makes a distinction because he's saying the sense of being, the sense of I am, arises in relationship to his body and mind. But it does not develop into I am this and I am like that. He's describing a process in the stages of awakening where we abandon the heavy duty clinging of I am like this. My personality is like this. It's very, that kind of a view is very fixed. And so he's already had some insight that he is not this and not that and not this and not that. So the clinging around personality view has vanished. But the more subtle conceit, the comparing, the sense of I am in relationship to experience continues to arise. This understanding of conceit is wedded with the contemplation of impermanence. And a skillful response to conceit isn't to just abolish it, it's to simply see it changing, to simply see how rapidly and impermanent and changeable and fickle, fluctuating, are all the comparisons we could ever make. None of them actually describe a reality. Now, the third source from which thoughts spring are views. In Pali, the term is ditti. Beliefs, views. These lead to confusions. And it's the basic question, what do I believe? Specifically around believing in an inherently existing self-identity. The belief, this is myself. But what creates this me? What composes this experience of selfing? There are lots of moments in our experience, right? Hearing, seeing, sensing in the body, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking, sensing. When we identify with our moments of experience and claim them as ourselves, then we might construct the position of being the experiencer. But experience is really a sequence of momentary experiences. Momentary processes that arise and pass very rapidly. Every moment of perception is bound together through conditioned relationships of body and mind. As we experience the body and mind continuously changing, is our sense of self continuously changing? Does that mean that who I believed I was 5 minutes ago is no longer who I believe myself to be now? I'm a different person because the sensations that I had 5 minutes ago are different than the sensations that I have now. when we look at how fluid our experience actually is and how dynamic the mind and body is, we realize that there is no place that we can actually build up a sense of self. We string together various experiences with a story of self, a belief, a view of self, a personality view. But in reality, what could we really say is self? Where is it in the body? Is there anything in the body that is me? Is it this elbow? Is it the eyelash? Is it the heart? Is it the liver? What about the mind? Is there something in the mind that we could say is me, is self? We look, and we look again, and we look again, and we look again. We hear a great deal of teachings on self, not self, the construction of self, the contemplation of not self, letting go of attachment to self-concepts, abandoning personality view. And some people interpret these teachings to mean, doesn't this mean that you're asking me to destroy the ego? But I've just done 10 years of therapy to develop a healthy ego, and that was expensive. I come on one retreat, and now you want me to abolish the ego? We're not suggesting that you abolish anything at all. Destroy. Destroy anything. In fact, perhaps there's nothing there to destroy. We're not even promoting a doctrine of no self. Dementia patients don't know who they are. Some stroke patients don't know what's who's who, what's what. I'm not suggesting that these are enlightened states. The Buddha and all the great disciples knew who they were. They knew what their roles were. They knew what their responsibilities were. They acted very responsibly in society. They had a strict code of conduct. They had a form of right livelihood. They shared the teachings. They lived in community. They maintained a congenial and proper relationship and order with the villagers and with the governments of their times. They interacted very responsibly and held great respect and regard for the role that they occupied and behaved accordingly. They knew who they were, and they knew what their role was. They knew how to function in society. They weren't wandering around saying, I'm no self. No self, no responsibilities. I can do what I want. They knew very clearly who they were, and they knew how to think. And they weren't afraid of using the words I and me. They didn't use funny language like, these five aggregates affected by clinging are giving the Dhamma talk tonight. Your minds and bodies should do walking meditation next. You know, they just said I and me and you as conventional normal language. The Buddhist teaching invites us to investigate the experience. What is our experience to know how it is we construct a sense of self, and what is it we take to be self, and what is this self composed of? It is not about finding a no self. or constructing a good Buddhist no-self. It's not creating a good Buddhist view of no-self. We simply look and we find no-self. And what do we look at? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. We look at experience because it's in experience that we might construct a sense of self or that we might realize the emptiness of that concept of self. The view of a stable existing person, personality view, is the classic description of wrong view. It misses the conditionality of experience and ignores the relational arising, the dependent arising of experience, because our bodies don't arise out of nothing, and our thoughts, sometimes they seem to come out of the blue, but they do not arise out of nothing. They arise out of causes and conditions. There was a monk at the time of the Buddha named Sati, Venerable Sati. Sati, the son of a fisherman. And he held what was called a pernicious view. I'll let you translate that one. It's a fun English word, pernicious. It basically means a false view, a twisted view, a corrupted view. And the view basically was the belief in a soul, an eternal existing soul, Atta. Yes. You probably know Atta, right? Atman. In Pali, Atta. And so what Venerable Sati asked the Buddha was, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. And the Buddha explained, no, it is not this consciousness, this soul, that transmigrates and moves from one lifetime to the next. There is no eternal soul. But instead, he says, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on I and form, it is reckoned as I consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on ear and sound, it is reckoned as ear consciousness. And similarly, when consciousness arises dependent on body and touch, it's reckoned as body consciousness through all the sense doors. There is not an I who sees experience, or a self who touches things, or a being who tastes things. But seeing occurs, tasting occurs, touching occurs, and consciousness arises in this process of cognizing, of knowing that experience. Consciousness arises dependent on sensory contact. The conditions for this sensory contact are described in a doctrine called the 12 links of dependent arising. And these are taught in forward order and reverse order through arising and ceasing functions as follows. You don't have to memorize this just yet. I make my students at home all memorize this, so if you'd like, it's not a bad idea, but listen carefully. With ignorance as condition, formations come to be. With formations as condition, consciousness. With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold sense base. With the sixfold sense base as condition, contact. With contact as condition, feeling. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, being comes to be. With being as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. You got it? Those of you that have been meditating more than 5 retreats, if you don't know this, I recommend it. When you're at home, write it down, read it over, get it under your belt. I think you'll find that it will support your practice and your understanding of how experience happens when you actually can know some of these links by heart. It's not that you recite them in your meditation practice, but sometimes these teachings are very helpful to have to know, to internalize, to memorize. So where is the self in this process of conditioning? Which part can we say is I, me, or mine? So the Buddha taught this venerable Sati, these 12 links of dependent arising, to describe the conditioned relationships of how experience comes to be, to dispel the idea that there is a self who is creating experience or is having experience, but instead starts to see the dynamic arising of experience, which is where consciousness occurs. And then the Buddha said, knowing and seeing in this way, would you run back to the past thus? Were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what? What did we become in the past? Did anybody have thoughts of past today? It's a little formalized in the language here, but basically if our thoughts run to the past, constructing who we were, what we did, what we want, we're doing the same process. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you run forward to the future thus? Shall we be in the future? Shall we not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what? What shall we become in the future? Did you have any plans today? Maybe you moved to the future to construct that sense of an eternal self, that sense of a self that's going to be there when you finally get there. No, venerable sir. And then he went, knowing and seeing in this way, would you now be inwardly perplexed about the present thus? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? No, venerable sir. So he looks at the way we construct thoughts of past and present and future, and construct a sense of self out of those proliferations of thoughts. And so the insight that uproots personality view, distorted views, is the insight into what is not self. We don't stop the thoughts from arising. The process is so much simpler than that. We stop believing the thoughts that arise. We stop identifying with our thoughts. You can notice when you become someone by identifying with the thought. And when a thought simply arises and the mind is light, it's porous, it's opened, free from grasping, and the thought fades and passes. No problem is created if thoughts arise without attachment. Then thoughts are self-liberating. They arise and pass and create no disturbance. I'd like to end with a verse, if I find it. One of the Enlightenment poems of the great disciples of the Buddha. just as a rain cloud would settle, the dust that's been raised by the wind, so all conceptions come to rest when one sees clearly with wisdom. Let's have a few quiet minutes, please. Now, this is a very precious time of the retreat. We're right in the middle. It also can be a time when the energies are building. It's important to reaffirm the commitment to the silence, the stillness, and the retreat container, the retreat itself. It's very easy at this point of the retreat to let the mind spin off into anything the mind can spin off to. I encourage you to trust the process and to let it unfold, to relax, to be at ease, and to know that this process is working. You don't have to rush to make anything happen. If something occurs that's slightly unfamiliar to you, look at it mindfully. Watch it, see it. Observe it, learn from it. Trust your own capacity to explore your relationship to the body and to the mind. Trust your capacity to look into your own mind. I would encourage you to let go of comparisons. If you thought by the fifth day you should be over all those hindrances, five hindrances, get rid of one each day, should be done. It may not work out that way. In fact, it usually doesn't. Never does. Be patient with yourself. Enjoy the process. It's a precious thing that we're doing here, cultivating the mind. And I have tremendous respect for you for coming here and doing this work together. It is important work. Enjoy your practice. Worry. My teacher, Pawak Sayadaw, often said that to me. He'd say, "Don't worry, don't worry, don't worry." And there were quite a few times when that was quite enough instruction, actually. Don't worry. Trust the process. Don't worry. The volume of notes that we have received has massively increased. So please, don't worry. Some of your notes will go unanswered. And so if you still have the question at the next time that there's a Q&A before lunch, questions and answers, then please use the questions and answers time. And relax. Don't worry. It's working. And we're all in this. We're all sitting here silently looking at our own minds. You may feel like you're doing it alone, but we're doing it together. Don't worry.